I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close, but not too close, reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope gain for a poem that interests us some new readers and listeners. And I say listeners because Poem Talk poems are available in recordings as part of our Penn Sound Archive writing.upenn.edu/pennsound. Today, I'm here in Philadelphia at the Kelly Writer's House in our third floor Garrett studio, joined by John Timpain, a poet, teacher, and for the last bunch of years, the commentary page editor for the Philadelphia Inquirer, frequent contributor to the Inky Sunday Ideas section, and dear friend of the Writer's House, one of our earliest local supporters, and author of Yes, It's True, Poetry for Dummies. Love that book. I own a copy. And by Tom Devaney, poet, teacher, critic, and a great reviewer, author of two poetry collections, A Series of Small Boxes and The American Pragmatist Fell in Love, my favorite title, and a nonfiction book, Letters to Ernesto Neto. Is that Neto or Neto?
Neto.
Neto. Got it wrong both times. Comes to us today from Haverford College, where he's teaching, and is back home here at the Writer's House, where he was our beloved program coordinator for a number of years. And by Jerome McGann, author of many, many, many works, including books about or editions of Byron, Rossetti, Wordsworth, Swinburne, and The Scholar's Art, Literature and Scholarship in an Administered World, 2006, Are the Humanities Inconsequent, 2009, The Romantic Ideology, a well-known work of 1983, and so much more, and who has done great important work in the realm of textual criticism. Hello to you all. Tom, welcome back to the Writer's House.
Good to see you, Al.
Your old haunt. And John, we see you at least a couple times a year, but this is your first time on Poem Talk.
Thanks. Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Great to see you. And Jerry, so good that you made the trip.
Honored.
To be here. From Virginia, my alma mater. Thanks for agreeing to be on Poem Talk. Well, today we'll be talking about a poem by Edgar Allan Poe, Dreamland. Dreamland. Sometimes hyphenated, sometimes the L is capitalized, sometimes it's one word. First published in 1844. Of course, we don't have a recording of Poe performing the poem, even assuming he ever performed it. But happily, Penn Sound's classics page includes a fairly new set of recordings of Poe's verse made by our own Jerry McGann. The recording we'll hear is 2 minutes and 41 seconds, and now here it is, Jerome McGann reading Poe's Dreamland.
Dreamland. By a route obscure and lonely, haunted by ill angels only, where an eidolon named Night on a black throne reigns upright, I have reached these lands, but newly from an ultimate dim Thule, from a wild weird clime that lieth sublime, out of space, out of time. Bottomless vales and boundless floods and chasms and caves and Titan woods, with forms that no man can discover for the tears that drip all over, mountains toppling evermore into seas without a shore, seas that restlessly aspire, surging unto skies of fire, lakes that endlessly outspread their lone waters, lone and dead, their still waters, still and chilly, with the snows of the lolling lily. By the lakes that thus outspread their lone waters, lone and dead, their sad waters, sad and chilly, with the snows of the lolling lily, by the mountains, near the river, murmuring lowly, murmuring ever, by the gray woods, by the swamp, where the toad and the newt encamp, by the dismal tarns and pools, where dwell the ghouls, by each spot the most unholy, in each nook most melancholy, there the traveler meets aghast sheeted memories of the past, shrouded forms that start and sigh as they pass the wanderer by, white-robed forms of friends long given in agony to the earth and heaven. For the heart whose woes are legion, 'tis a peaceful, soothing region. For the spirit that walks in shadow, 'tis an El Dorado. But the traveler traveling through it may not, dare not openly view it. Never its mysteries are exposed to the weak human eye unclosed. So wills its king, who hath forbid the uplifting of the fringed lid. And thus the sad soul that here passes beholds it but through darkened glasses. By a route obscure and lonely, haunted by ill angels only, where an Eidolon named Night on a black throne reigns upright, I have wandered home but newly from this ultimate dim Thule.
Let me start with this, maybe what might seem a silly question. The three of you are Poeans. The three of you love Poe. And my question is, for people who love Poe, why is this a good poem to either start with or be among your first four or five poems to read? Is the characteristic of Poe? To what extent is it? Jerry, I think I'd start with you.
It is characteristic of Poe. I wanted to do this instead of, say, Conqueror Worm or The Raven or Ulalume, some of the more famous ones, because, in my opinion, it is one of his most majestic poems and one of the most characteristic. Most of his poems are about poetry, and this one is it's a classic example of a poem that is meditating on poetry.
You've already started us into a difficult territory here, because if one types in Poe Dreamland into a web search engine, you get all kinds of, I think, literally sophomoric comments about how it's about the state between death and life, and already we're somewhere else. Yeah. So that's very interesting. John, your thought on how Poe-esque this is, or what do we say, Poean or Poe-esque?
This pulls what I and a lot of my friends used to call the Poe trick, which is he gives a title to something, and the poem, you could say, is about that thing, but it is so intensely about it that it leaves it, that it transcends it. That referent, that sucker floats. And what is The Raven about? What is The Maelstrom about? What is Annabel Lee about? What is this poem about? This shows when a poem leaves the subject matter and just goes and wanders where it will, it's really an object lesson in how hard it is to say what poems are, quote-unquote, about, and that is Poe all over.
That's great. It's already a meta conversation, because I didn't ask what it was about. I asked how characteristic of Poe it was. Tom, your thought on its Poe-esque quality?
It's an indicative poem for Poe, because he's exploring the dreamland state, and it's just sort of in its themes sort of go down the list for, you know, what Poe is after. It explores the goth, it explores this the mental states, and less so the sort of the real states, the states of the everyday. So we're already, he's interested in kind of finding out, going on these journeys in states that we're not used to going into.
For a guy who's going to unusual states, why does the relatively regular meter befit that goal? Or maybe you're going to tell me it's not very regular.
It isn't very regular, no. Actually. It's three beat. That's
three
true.
Beat almost entirely.
Yes, it is.
And rhymes.
With a couple of variations.
Right.
But the patterns actually vary quite a lot. And one of the most interesting aspects of the poem is, in fact, its odd adherence to basically a three beat meter.
Odd meaning it varies
you're never quite sure, exactly what meter is controlling the thing. I'd like to pick up on something that John said, because I think what he said about it is exactly right. Even though in a peculiar, very, very Poean sense, there is a literal journey that goes
right,
on here.
Right.
From some place, it's a route that comes from someplace and goes to someplace, but you never know exactly where it comes from or where it's going to, and whether Dreamland is where you came from, where you're going to, or whether it's the route that you're on.
Mm. An easy reading, which we will dismiss immediately, is a poem that has the word dream in the title that begins and ends roughly in the same language with a little bit of a difference, can be a frame device for the dreamer. You know, you
yeah.
dream, you go, and you come back home, as it were. Why wouldn't that be a good sufficient reading?
I mean, it's perfectly good
yeah.
as a reading.
Thank you.
It's perfectly good as a reading. it might not do total justice to how playful the poem is and how much the writer lets it escape him. In other words, I actually don't think all of this poem was in his control, and I think he loved that.
Where is this? This picks up maybe on Jerry's comment about the meter. What are some examples of the writing that seems to get away from him, which I assume would be consonant with the idea of variations of the meter?
He begins with a theme which he uses as a coda at the end. Actually, it establishes sort of a sonata form for the entire poem. But he says, "I have reached these lands." So we're there, these, that we're there now at the beginning, from an ultimate dim tule. And ultimate means the final, the last, a particular last dim land called tule. Then at the end, he says, "I have wandered home, but newly, from this ultimate dim tule." So where is tule? Mm-hmm. And how'd you get home from there, and you started
Because you're in a dream.
That's not much of a because that seems to explain where it does not. If it's ultimate, it's the last. So how can you have two of them? And how do you get to one and come from another? You see, so...
That's all laid down in the very first stanza, actually.
Yes.
If you go by a route, and I've reached these lands, and I've come from... an ultimate dim tule from this place and then out of space, out of time. Then you move into the next stanza, and the question is, where are you at this point?
Right. Is it a description of tule, or is it a description of now where you've come to after tule?
And yes. When you get to the second stanza, the second long stanza, you realize that, well, actually, it could be the route that you're on, because the second stanza or the second long stanza is a picture of a route.
Tom?
I think Poe was a purist, so I really am stuck on the line from an ultimate dim tule. To me, this the whole perspective of the poem, it doesn't come from one place and go to another. He wants to stay there from an ultimate dim tule. This is where this is sort of Poe's dream to kind of write a poem that's out of space and out of time. This is what makes this poem very poetic to me too. Like if he can achieve the out of space, the out of time. Then he's doing that. He's charting new territory, which was revolutionary for him.
So tule is a proper noun, and it's a T-H-U-L-E, capital T, and it's some sort of generic, very northerly place, sort of Scandinavian,
yes.
Right?
Yes. Okay.
Thought I'd throw that.
I just want to say that from my point of view, you know that it's that distant place, but I wasn't reaching to exactly know what it was because it plays into this. This faraway-ness.
Well, you didn't have. You don't have to
just
know that.
It's a texture word.
But the phrase "an ultimate dim tule," ultimate and both work to suggesting it's a generic nature. I suppose
it's important, I think, to realize that by the time you do get to the end, the distinction between being awake and being asleep has been erased.
Mm.
All life is a dream becomes an available idea when you get to, for example, "and thus the sad soul that here passes beholds it, but through darkened glasses," with the allusion to St. Paul.
Yes.
That's an allusion to a text that refers to living in life with, wakefulness, only you see through darkened glasses. Mm.
"For the heart whose woes are legion, 'tis a peaceful, soothing region. For the spirit that walks in shadow, 'tis an Eldorado. But the traveler traveling through it may not, dare not openly view it. Never its mysteries are exposed to the weak human eye unclosed. So wills its king, who hath forbid the uplifting of the fringed lid. And thus the sad soul that here passes beholds it but through darkened glasses."
John referred to a slippery reference or following up Jerry's idea that this is about a poem about poetry or metapoetic. So we have the "it" of the second to last stanza, which would seem to refer to El Dorado. 'Tis an El Dorado. And then you have traveling through it. Then you have dare not openly view it. Never its mysteries. So wills its king. There's a king of something. Beholds it, and even I, you know, who's just getting used to this poem, thought, well, that's El Dorado, but that doesn't quite do it. So what would we say it is or points to?
The dream, state of sleep. I mean, it's multiple, as you're suggesting. But look at those distinctions. For the heart, for the spirit, but the traveler. Are those things actually being distinguished, or are they the same thing? For the heart, it's peaceful. For the spirit, well, it's El Dorado. But for the traveler, and so a series of distinctions are made, and then they're kind of erased because they kind of blend into each other.
What does it mean to dare not openly view X, whatever X is? What does that mean, to dare not openly view it? Is it scary? Is it too closely facing the ineffable?
You can't. There's a famous passage in the Marginalia, 1845, where and Baudelaire picked up on this in the famous Journal Intime, the My Heart Laid Bare passage, and he talks there about a person telling the absolute truth about his soul, that no one would ever dream of doing this.
This is pretty modern kind of writing, right? I mean, to use an it that is not only unidentifiable as a referent, but is also referring to the thing you shouldn't be facing.
Whatever it is, it has an ominous power.
Is this why Poe, in short, is so appealing to you mod types?
This shows that the poem is about limits. And even in A Limit Beyond, he goes to that limit, which kind of honors the mystery. And so when we say that Poe is symbolic and we can read him on allegorical levels, there's still that only goes to a certain limit. The hidden meanings remain hidden in the poem, and that's what's sort of brilliant about the poem.
So do you generally not like to read him allegorically, let's say, when you're teaching him?
There's things that Poe, he's a symbolist poet, and what does that mean? Why do the French poets love him so much? It doesn't mean that everything signifies on an allegorical level, that there are these symbols that are identifiable, but they don't necessarily reveal themselves X, you know, equals whatever.
Jerry, question for you. I read somewhere that the only line that Poe sometimes indented or not left justified is out of space and time. I understand some editions have that indented. Is that true? And if so, what does it signify, if anything?
Well, whether the question about whether it's the only line that's struck to an extreme left position, I don't know. But it is, that's true. That is the way it appears.
It's a pretty cool line to do that to,
yes,
right? Out of space and time.
Well, that the metric of that line is also very interesting.
Yes.
That's the first place where you actually see the metric being wrenched. And then later on, you watch it sort of undergo different kinds of transformations.
Especially in that third group of lines, which I just think is an absolute school of what to do if you want to really screw around with meter.
Say more, detail.
Oh, well, okay. So first of all, the brilliant line, "Where dwell the ghouls," the shortest line,
right,
comes out of no place.
That's ghouls, two beats. Am I right?
Where dwell.
You're going to count.
Depending on how you read it. I read it, "Where dwell."
You read it three.
You could. "Where dwell the ghouls." You definitely could.
But of course, what ghouls, we just aren't
informed.
Right.
You know, they're capitalized, but that's all we know. Mm-hmm. But how about this? "By the gray woods, by the swamp, by the mountains, near the river." This is a way of taking what had started out vaguely as sort of some kind of trochaic tetrameter, you know.
Right.
And just putting it.
Don't be embarrassed at knowing that.
You're taking the little poodle for a walk is what
right,
you're doing.
Right, you're taking the poodle for a walk.
Yeah.
Right.
And, I mean, this is a poet whose analogous art is not sculpture like someone like Ezra Pound would be, where it's deletion that defines the poetic choice. This is musical analogy where it's elaboration. And that's what makes this Poe for me.
"By the gray woods, by the swamp, where the toad and the newt encamp, by the dismal tarns and pools, where dwell the ghouls, by each spot the most unholy, in each nook most melancholy, there the traveler meets aghast sheeted memories of the past, shrouded forms that start and sigh as they pass the wanderer by, white-robed forms of friends long given in agony to the earth and heaven."
You see, in the 19th century didn't cultivate the interpretation of poetry. They cultivated the recitation of poetry. And the mode of, in fact, learning about poetry was through the reciters that everybody had in school. My grandmother had them. They came down to my mother, for that matter. I learned poetry through recitation through my mother. Mm-hmm. And Poe is a poet to be recited, as is Longfellow, for that matter.
Did Poe perform, do you know?
Oh, sure.
And would he have performed this?
I don't know whether he did, actually.
Do we have any evidence in the letters or otherwise of what he was like as a reader of his poetry?
I can't remember that, but I do remember people were mesmerized by his conversation. That's true.
Mm. And one imagines that if they were mesmerized by conversation, they would have been mesmerized by this.
And he did go, when The Raven was published, that's when he became, he read that publicly many times. So.
Before we go away, we have to call attention to that immortal second line, haunted by ill angels only. I would give anything to have written conceived ill angels only.
Yes.
It's too good.
Unbelievable.
What do you take those ill angels to be? Are they sickly?
Well, that's it. Are they thrown out of heaven?
They're angels of
because
ill.
They're immorally deranged, or are they biologically...
Well, I want to pick up on this. You know, a really big question in this entire poem is why everything is so sad. Why does it have to be? It seems as though it
even
has to be.
Wandering home seems sad.
It seems as though it has to be. But why? And this is not explained. It seems to be the rule. Wherever
why
you're
is it, if it's so sad, why do I always have a smile on my face when I realize that newly rhymes with tuly?
Well, why do you have a smile on your face when you read any Poe poem? Because as a metrical or poetic performance, as poetry, it is a joy. The subjects are always very, very dark. And part of the brilliance of it is the play between those two things.
And he was exploring the conventions of the Gothic story and the Gothic romanticism here. But there's something about his vision that goes beyond his poetry, I think. And then when you say where he stumbles, like rhyming chili and lily, you know,
Poe?
He doesn't stumble, but if you don't read it commandingly, like we've heard it here, it can come off.
Well, clearly, if the poem simply were the sum of its Gothic conventions, we wouldn't be talking about it in 2011.
Right. But the thing is...
So what would you say? I'm going to put you on the spot. What would you say is the difference, in a nutshell, the distinction? How does it rise above simply its Gothic conventions? In a nutshell, this is a sort of poem talk one-liner.
Because Poe is honestly charting a kind of cognitive state, and he's there for it, and he's meticulously trying to explore it.
Nice. Let's go around and get final words on this poem. Something that we haven't mentioned that you couldn't possibly imagine a poem talk on this poem without mentioning.
I want to mention a concept called line speed. This guy has an amazing ear, and he is able to tune the reading speed of lines according to the end stopped consonants and the clusters of consonants in a line. And the line I want to read is, white-robed forms of friends long given. There's no way to get through that really fast. And that's because of the MS and the white-robed, and he's basically breaking your jaw with the Anglo-Saxonisms in the line, and he wants to slow that line down so you see those white-robed forms of the friends long given to earth and heaven.
It's amazing what words can do.
Yes, and he can do with words,
That's great. Jerry, a last thought on this?
That's right on the mark, I must say. His poems call attention to words, and to the pace of language. They are almost proto-language poems, to my mind.
Did you say proto-language poems?
Yeah, because it's the word as such that we're looking at here. He's almost evacuated the poem of what we regard as moral content, and so called attention to its, you know.
I know you've written about these kinds of things, but may I invite you to draw the line from Poe to language-centered poetry, more contemporary, a little further? How would you describe how we get from one place to the next?
Well, the problem with poetry in our day, or one of the great problems with poetry, is that we come to it with certain kind of preconceptions, especially meaning preconceptions. So one of the great polemical efforts of what we call language-centered poetry was to pull one away from that and create what Charles famously and funnily calls the attack of the difficult poems. The poems are there to be difficult. Excuse me, in order to break down these
barriers. Poe begins that breakdown, maybe not as consciously, but he does it how? What's his great
haunted
method?
By ill angels only, or the with the snows of the lolling lily. I mean, you have to be very careful about that line. There's no way that you're going to be able to deliver it if you're not thoughtful.
Thank you, Tom. Final word.
For all of the ways that we can read into the poem. The poem remains strange, and that's why the poem remains relevant.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why André Breton sort of claims Poe, and that's why anybody who's sort of actively engaged in the word would, whether it's language poetry or Elizabeth Bishop or so many people who love this poem, it's available for them.
It's the Elizabeth Bishop that was attracted to surrealism that liked Poe, which mm-hmm. is my favorite Elizabeth Bishop. Well, we like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two of Gathering Paradise, which is a chance for several of us to spread wide our narrow hands to gather a little something really poetically good, to hail or commend someone or something going on in the poetry world. Who wants to gather paradise first? John Timpain.
A book of poems that Tom just reviewed for me by Ross Gay called Bringing Down the Shovel, a local guy who's made good, just a wonderful poet. I think everyone should get this book. It's humane, it's political, but it's also Ross Gay in a way that only he can be. And I might also add, I'm very excited about Poetry Month coming up, April, because the Inquirer is going to search out a bunch of young poets and feature them
the
online.
The Philadelphia Inquirer is a newspaper that still, insofar as it can, care about poetry, largely thanks to John Timpain. Thank you. Tom, since you got mentioned in the first Gathering Paradise.
I have two books next to my bed right now. One is called Becoming Weather by Chris Martin, and the other one's called Late in the Antenna Fields by Alan Gilbert. And the thing about these two books is that they're both sort of interested in a kind of music, Gilbert in an ambient music, and maybe Martin in sort of like an intersection of like rap and R&B and Nietzsche. And I love these both of these books, and they're kind of maybe connected to this conversation and beyond.
Wonderful. Jerry.
Yes, I want to mention the name of Jeffrey Herrick. He's a very old friend of mine from the early 70s. He left the United States during the Vietnam era, never came back, went to Morocco, and now lives in Japan. He's a poet, a wonderful poet. He teaches at Ochimon University in Osaka. He has 2000, Patterns and Fittings in Zipangu. In 2006, he published a collection of poems called Valences, and just out, 2011, a really remarkable book called Poetry Ings, which are a series of prose poems commenting on and meditating on poets who are also important critics, from Sidney and Samuel Daniel to the present day.
Fabulous. This is the first time that Samuel Daniel has been mentioned in the Gathering Paradise session. Can you spell your poet's name again?
H-E-R-R-I-C-K, Jeffrey with a J.
Terrific. Well, that's all the ill angels we have time for on Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writer's House at the University of Pennsylvania and the Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks to my guests, John Timpain, Tom Devaney, and Jerome McGann, and to Poem Talk's director and engineer, James Lamar, and to our editor, as always, Steve McLaughlin. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us again soon for another Poem Talk.